Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We got a month. Anybody have any good ideas for what to do about the debt limit? Because there ain't nothing happening in Washington. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 14th of January. Good as always to have you with us. So here is where we find ourselves with a month or so to go until the Treasury Department hits the debt limit. We're nowhere. No trillion-dollar coin. The White House ruled that out this weekend. The president has already said he's not going to use the 14th Amendment as a way to say the debt limit is unconstitutional. So question number two at his press conference today from NBC's Chuck Todd was basically, so, Mr. President, what are you going to do now?
Chuck, what I'm saying to you is that there is no simpler solution, no ready, credible solution, other than Congress either give me the authority to raise the debt ceiling or exercise the responsibility that they have kept for themselves and raise the debt ceiling, because this is about paying your bills.
Or, in not quite so many words, yeah, there is no plan B. We called Congress, by the way, to see what it had to say. Speaker of the House John Boehner did put out a written statement, but declined our invitation to chat. Got to say, it does kind of seem like all these government shutdown threats and the debt ceiling squabbling and fiscal cliff part two, which looms ahead of us in a month or so, it does seem like nothing more than a high-stakes game of chicken, where the only way to win, in a manner of speaking, is to lose, to stay on course no matter how perilous and not be the guy who turns away. So let's cue up an oldie but a goodie, Rebel Without a Cause, 1955, James Dean, and the classic Game of Chicken.
Hey, Toreador.
Congress either give me the authority to raise the debt
ceiling. She signals.
Ceiling.
We head for the edge.
Or.
The first man who jumps is a chicken.
We're going to blow up the economy.
Rebel Without a Cause, the annotated version, I guess you might call that. It's a good movie, gotta say. All right, the ticker symbol of the day this Monday is AAPL, Apple, of course, which closed above $500 a share by the hair on its chinny chin chin. Because there was news this morning the company has had to cut its parts orders for the iPhone 5, fewer screens for it specifically, because demand is apparently running considerably less than expected. According to some reports, the cutbacks amount to as much as half of previous production, amid worries that competition from Samsung and other Android phones is finally taking a chunk out of Apple's profits. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Yes, Apple is still the world's most valuable company, and yes, it virtually created the smartphone market. But Georgetown University marketing professor Ronald Goodstein says today's news is the most dramatic indication yet that the iPhone is being seriously threatened.
I think it's a really bad time for Apple.
At the beginning of 2011, the research firm IDC reports the iPhone's global market share was 23%. In this past holiday season, it was down to 14%. But at Endpoint Technology Associates, analyst Roger Kay still sees that as respectable.
Particularly when you realize that Apple has the most profitable segment, they actually get better margins than anybody.
Kay is concerned about reports that Apple is under pressure to sell a cheaper version of the iPhone. He says that harkens back to the early 1990s, when its computer business was in serious trouble.
The problem was somewhat the same. It was a higher quality experience, and it cost more. And people really did make decisions based on money. So they looked at it and said, wow, I really love those Macs, but I just can't afford them. And they go buy a PC reluctantly.
The company was nearly on death's door until the return of its Wunderkind founder.
iPhone. Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
Now, Georgetown professor Ronald Goodstein says Apple is relying on reinventing products that he says are losing their cool.
I don't think another version of anything for them is going to equal cool. They've got to truly innovate again.
And this time, Goodstein says the challenge is there is no Steve Jobs to come to the rescue. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The flu is, as of Friday, officially an epidemic. The Centers for Disease Control said so. And they also said they really want people to go out and get their shots. It's great advice if you can find a doctor or a pharmacy that still has the vaccine in stock. Shortages are being reported from New York to Texas to Illinois. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein stepped away from the health desk at WHYY to go figure out how come.
Want to know the secret to the flu vaccine business? Every year, the virus changes its structure just enough.
Which means that every year there is the need to make a new vaccine.
Adil Mahmood is a professor of molecular biology at Princeton and former president of Merck Vaccines. He says manufacturers are cautious.
Whatever ends up staying in their companies at the end of the season, they will have to destroy it and basically eat its cost.
At roughly $10 a pop to produce one dose of vaccine, companies don't exactly want to flood the market. So how do they decide how much to make? Donna Carey is a spokesperson for Sanofi Pasteur, one of the largest flu vaccine makers in the U.S.
The primary driver in determining how much vaccine we're going to make any year is how much our customers have ordered from us
before the season begins. So in years like this one, where deaths and hospitalizations are up and fear is growing and lots of people suddenly want shots, there's less vaccine on the shelves. But there are a couple of ways around this. The CDC approach, convince everyone to get a flu shot every year, that way companies would want to produce more, or Princeton Professor Mahmood's solution.
Come up with a vaccine that does not have to be produced every year. Therefore, you can stockpile it like any other vaccine that we have for any other disease.
He says a pan-flu vaccine is not wishing on a pharmaceutical star, believing a breakthrough is possible soon. But until that day comes, manufacturers will continue relying on last year's sales and this year's orders. So while you, me, and our neighbors are out hunting for flu shots this week, Sanofi Pasteur says it's already pre-booking for the fall. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders couldn't care less about all the back and forth in Washington. There was a good market rumor going on, though. Bloomberg said that Dell is going to be bought out by a private equity group. No official comment from anybody related to that one. Also, Ben Bernanke gave a talk out at the University of Michigan, took questions via Twitter, too, the Fed chairman did. All of that came after the close, though, so really just a whole lot of treading water at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It was bad news over the weekend for Spain's ruling conservative party. A new poll out on Sunday said only about a third of Spaniards would vote for the government again, that just a year after it came to power. The austerity measures that government has put into place have been felt by millions of Spaniards, those down the economic scale, perhaps most of all. In a shantytown called Cañada Real, outside Madrid, 30,000 people crowd into the European Union's largest illegal settlement. It's cinderblock homes and plastic sheeting and a growing number of Moroccan immigrants. John Lawrenson spoke to some of them.
Aziz is retiling the floor of the three-room house where he lives with his wife and son. It's an all right-looking place, nice little garden with a big, shady fig tree. But there's a snag with this property, quite a big snag. At any time, City Hall might send a bulldozer to smash it to pieces.
They have demolished houses near this one, and of course, I'm worried. Everyone's wondering, what if it happens to me? Where would I go? Of course, stealing is illegal, killing's illegal, selling drugs. But giving shelter to your children? How can that be illegal?
After Aziz washes the cement off his hands, we walk up to the mosque, a few children playing in the dusty road. The Cañada Real sits on public land designated as a shepherd's thoroughfare. No one has the right to build along this 10-mile strip, but the poor have long built shelters here nevertheless. Many live with no water or electricity. The faithful can't all fit in the mosque. 100 men pray outside. Nearly all are construction workers. During Spain's property boom, they built some of the thousands of houses that are now standing empty and unsold. Houses they've built plenty, but they can't afford to live in one, not a legal one in any case. The Cañada Real is growing with new arrivals like this man, Noureddin Amzo.
Now I'm living here, but before I'm in the center of Madrid, it's very expensive.
So you moved here because it's cheaper to
yeah,
live here?
Yeah, yeah, actually, yeah.
Amzo came to Spain to build houses. Are you working now?
No, I'm not working now. I was 1 year without work. I'm asking everybody and look everywhere, but nothing.
He's thinking about returning to Morocco. Others, he says, have done so already. This man, Milud, is resolved to sit out the recession in Spain with the help of his religion.
Islam.
We are protected by God. We Muslims aren't so worried about the crisis because God knows all and gives all. God provides.
And will they be allowed to stay living in these rough-made houses they built for themselves on the edge of Spain's battered economy? Inshallah, says Milud, God willing. In the Cañada Real, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
You want to talk mega stores? Walmart has a pretty good handle on that concept. Yet, for the past couple of years, it's been testing hundreds of smaller locations, markets where big stores maybe wouldn't work quite so well. That gets us to the smallest Walmart in the country, 2,500 square feet, opening soon on the campus of Georgia Tech in Atlanta, GA. Shannon Mullen reports.
Picture the average single-family home. Now imagine a Walmart that size.
The 2,500 square foot space is the only space we have available.
Rich Steele is head of auxiliary services at Georgia Tech.
They're willing to fit their concept into the available retail space.
The location is set to open this spring in a former ribs joint. It's not clear what items will stay and what will go as Walmart shoehorns its big box sensibilities into a convenience store. Stephen Restivo is a spokesman for Walmart.
Customers associate Walmart with a broad assortment of products at an everyday low price, and we want to make sure to deliver on that promise, whether the store is 150,000 square feet or 2,500 square feet.
The retail chain pitched the idea to Georgia Tech a year ago after piloting the Walmart on-campus concept at the University of Arkansas. The new Georgia Tech location will feature a pharmacy, check cashing services, and a small selection of groceries. The move is part of Walmart's efforts to penetrate retail niches outside the big box, and its renowned buying power could challenge other players in the pharmacy and convenience store sector.
Walmart, as we all know, is a tremendously efficient retail machine.
Don Longo is editor of the industry trade Convenience Store News. He says so far, independent store operators don't see Walmart's foray into small market territory as a direct threat.
They really have not come up with the formula yet that would be a real competitive danger to really good small store operators who know how to operate in a very small footprint.
But with such a cash-ready customer base, the college campus could be the right laboratory for Walmart's small store experiment. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Basically, you have to have all this chopped up chicken junk and be able to coat it and have it not all fall apart and be able to freeze it and store it and whatnot. And that takes some complicated engineering.
The genius that is the chicken nugget, I kid you not. But first, let's do the numbers. Market started the week just kind of hanging around. The Dow Industrials up 18 points, a tenth of 1%, finished at 13,507, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ off 8 points, a quarter percent, 3117. The S&P 500 down a point, a tenth percent, ended at 1470. Apple dropped 3.5% today on that news that it's cut orders for iPhone 5 parts because of slowing sales. Supplier Cirrus Logic will sell more than half its chips to Apple. Fell 9% as a result. Struggling Dell, which knows what it's like to have once been a high-tech high flyer, shot up 13% on that report it might go private. Hewlett-Packard added nearly 5% as it regained the title top PC maker. From Lenovo, funny I didn't know that was a title. United Parcel Service delivered a 1.7% increase after dropping a $7 billion bid for TNT Express. That's a Dutch shipping company. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.85%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
from the Marketplace Datebook. Here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. A look back at the holiday shopping season. The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for December. Will your state get an A? The group Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety issues its annual report card, ranking each state on highway safety. And California public health officials are prepping for their fight against the flu and encouraging residents to get vaccinated. A shot may be in my future. I'm not just practicing my Kathleen Turner impression. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. 15 years or so ago, when I lived in Beijing, there it was bad. It was really bad some days, but never anything like what's been happening in northern China the past couple of days. Smog levels in Beijing were nearly 40 times higher than the limits set by the World Health Organization. It's the really bad stuff that's in the air, too, the tiny particles that get down deep into your lungs. It is a problem, to be sure, for people, but also quite possibly for the government, if China's new urban consumer class gets sick and tired of it all. From Shanghai, here's Marketplace's Rob Schmitz.
The last time the air was this bad in Beijing, the air monitor attached to the U.S. Embassy pumped out a reading which was labeled crazy bad. That was 2 years ago. This time, it's worse.
This is emergency-level air pollution.
Alex Wong is an environmental law professor at University of California, Berkeley. One of Beijing's biggest hospitals reported treating twice as many heart attacks over the weekend. The Beijing Children's Hospital said a third of its outpatient visits in the past 2 days were due to lung ailments. Last year, China saw an uptick in protests from the country's growing middle class over environmental concerns, concerns that Wong says could now be reaching a tipping point.
For a while now, the government has been aware that environmental pollution issues very much have the potential to trigger instability. And so they've been responding to this gradually, but the problem seemingly has not gotten better.
Beijing has moved factories outside the city and tightened vehicle emission standards. But Zhou Rong of Greenpeace Asia says this time around, the smog is coming from smaller cities outside the capital, places where local governments have done little to curb pollution in their quest for more economic growth.
Especially for the local government. I think they should really need to balance the GDP growth and the people's health.
In the end, better air would help the economy. The World Bank found that China's air pollution causes damage equal to 5% of the country's GDP each year. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Remember all the pictures of flooded cars after Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast? Lost causes, as far as the owners are concerned, but many of the 200,000-plus cars themselves are finding a second life. Buyers as far away as Mississippi and Arizona are dealing with the effects of a storm that didn't hit them at all, till now at least. Sally Herships reports.
Remember that episode of Seinfeld where a stinky valet parks Jerry's car? The guy's BO is so bad, Jerry tells the maitre d' the restaurant should pay to clean his car.
What do you mean, stunk up?
I mean the car stinks. George's, the car stinks.
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 The smell is so bad, the car has to be abandoned. Compared to Seinfeld, Hurricane Sandy caused much more damage to cars, but many haven't been abandoned. They're sold for scrap or sometimes to dishonest buyers who are hoping to make a bundle.
These are professional con men that do this for a living.
Chris Basso works with Carfax, and he's talking about people who fix cars damaged by Sandy and then fix the car's record so there's no mention of the original damage.
They're able to manipulate the documents needed to get a clean title. They alter the paperwork.
The process is called title washing, and Basso says it could affect one out of every five cars damaged by the storm, especially when those cars are moved to states like Arizona and Mississippi, which have some of the weakest title requirements. Frank Scafidi works with the National Insurance Crime Bureau. He says, buyer beware.
If you've been shopping for a specific used vehicle, and now all of a sudden you see one just like you want, and the price is drastically lower than you're used to, that's kind of a clue.
Chris Basso says buyers should check the car's history for evidence of flood damage on sites like Carfax. So do what Seinfeld should have done before he handed over his keys. Take a good deep whiff to make sure nothing smells fishy. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Maybe you buy the 6-piece or the 12-piece or freezer packs, or maybe you avoid them altogether. But we're talking chicken nuggets, specifically Chicken McNuggets, one of a certain company's most iconic products. But curiously, a patent on them McDonald's does not have. Jordan Weissman has been writing about McNuggets and the intellectual ownership thereof for The Atlantic magazine. It's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So I have to tell you, one does not think of the humble Chicken McNugget and intellectual property, generally speaking, in the same breath, right?
No, not usually.
So how'd you get there?
So recently, Fred Turner, who was this super influential CEO at McDonald's, died at the age of 80. Fred Turner, he was the guy we can thank for things like the Egg McMuffin and the drive-through window and the Happy Meal. I mean, this guy sort of made, in a lot of ways, fast food what it is today.
Yeah.
Part of his legacy, I noticed, was the Chicken McNugget. McDonald's introduced it first in 1980 and then went national with it in 1983 while he was CEO.
And yet McDonald's did not invent the Chicken McNugget.
Yeah. And, you know, so I got to doing a little bit of reading, and before it was even kind of a glimmer in, you know, Ronald McDonald's eye, there was actually a poultry scientist at Cornell named Robert Baker, who was, I mean, just devoted to chicken and chicken products. And he would, you know, find ways to make chicken hash, chicken meatloaf, you know, just different ways to kind of expand the market for poultry, which actually back in the 70s wasn't that large. And one of his innovations was this thing called a chicken stick, which really was sort of a proto McNugget.
Yeah, it was hard to do, right?
Yeah. I mean, basically, you have to have all this chopped up chicken junk and be able to coat it and have it not all fall apart and be able to freeze it and store it and whatnot. And that takes some complicated engineering. And he did it. And the interesting thing about Baker, and this is what got me thinking about the IP aspect of this, he never patented any of his work.
He
would always just
gave it away.
He gave it away, exactly. He would publish it in these little bulletins and send it around to hundreds of companies, again, with the sort of the idea of expanding the chicken market. Flash forward to 1979, when McDonald's really wants to make a fried chicken product. And they tried all these different things, and they kind of come to the idea of selling something that's kind of like a French fry, but in chicken form.
Yeah.
And we can't really identify whether or not they absolutely 100% were using Baker's methods.
And that's the crux of this thing, right? Because of one of the many facets of patent law is you want everybody to get paid for their intellectual property. But at the same time, you want maximum public utility from good ideas.
Absolutely. And, you know, you can license your IP, right?
Yeah.
What you have a situation here is this academic research had sort of infiltrated its way through the industry, permeated it, right? And then you look at McDonald's, and why are they trying to innovate? Why are they creating this chicken nugget? Is it because they have some idea that they think they're going to be able to corner the market on and then keep anyone else from making it? No, they need a chicken product. In the late 70s, there was pressure to create something that they could sell that would be nominally a little bit healthier. You know, I think back now, oh my God, fried, you know, fried
that's right.
spongy
how
fried chicken was
healthy. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, but, you know, people still were scared about, you know, first kind of becoming aware of cholesterol and things. And so they needed to kind of enter a new market, and they needed a product that would sell well. And so the market itself, without the government coming and saying, okay, McDonald's, you're the only ones who can make a nugget, instead the market itself probably would have provided enough incentive for McDonald's to go and create it.
One cannot imagine this happening today. I mean, Baker does this in 1963. Here we are 50 years later, and you can't turn around without somebody filing a patent for something.
Yeah, especially universities. Huh. A lot of people, myself included, who think the patent system may have gotten a little bit out of hand, kind of mourn that loss. You know, at one point, research was kind of meant to feed this collective pool of knowledge, of know-how that an economy had. And what you find is, in a lot of instances, you don't really need strong patent laws in order to encourage people to invent.
Jordan Weissman at The Atlantic. Jordan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Trey Parker and Matt Stone clearly don't have enough to do. The creators of South Park and the Book of Mormon made some news today. They're going to take some of the millions of dollars they made in television and on Broadway and open up their own production house. Important Studios, it will humbly be called. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
Chances are you've never heard this song. So let's build a snowman. We can make it more of a snowman.
This one, on the other hand, you might be familiar with. I'm going down south, I'm gonna have myself time. That first tune is from the 1993 film Cannibal, the musical. Trey Parker and Matt Stone made it on a shoestring while they were in college. 4 years later, the first episode of South Park aired on Comedy Central. Almost instantly, the irreverent cartoon featuring bits like Jesus versus Santa became a huge hit. Then came South Park the movie.
They've shown a track record not only in television, but also with their play, Book of Mormon.
Catherine Arnold is an entertainment consultant in Los Angeles. She says that Parker and Stone's early adoption of online streaming for South Park gives them an advantage. They have direct access to their fans, which allows them to market their projects cheaply.
They're ahead of the curve, whereas the studio started in traditional media and marketing. These guys, that was their base from the very beginning.
From a business perspective, that makes their new studio a solid investment.
Startups are particularly attractive right now to investors.
Agata Kochkanowska is an entertainment industry analyst with Ibis World. She says that investors see opportunities for faster growth in these types of smaller production studios. By creating their own studio, Parker and Stone will have $300 million to spend on developing new shows. But perhaps the biggest perk is that they will have even more creative control over their projects. For an empire built on characters like Dancing Pooh, that can mean a lot. And they will get to keep a larger share of their profits. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a last word from the President of the United States on the way out.
Now, the other congressionally imposed deadline coming up is the so-called debt ceiling.
Okay, wait. Now, did you hear that? Here you go one more time.
Now, the other congressionally imposed deadline coming up is the so-called debt ceiling.
Far be it from me to pick nits with the leader of the free world, but I'm pretty sure it's just called the debt ceiling, right? Nothing so about it. Yes, pet peeve. So sue me. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 18 points, a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ down 8 points, a quarter percent. The S&P 500 slipped a single point, a tenth of 1%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Jolie Podokas, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.